Good afternoon. This is Chair Ruth Richardson, and pursuant to House Rule 10.1, I call this remote meeting of the Education Policy Committee to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance.
Chair Richardson?
Present.
Vice Chair Hassan?
Present.
Representative Erickson?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski?
Present.
Representative Bennett?
Present.
Representative Berg?
Present.
Representative Bo?
Present.
Representative Christensen? Representative Edelson?
Present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Frazier?
Present.
Representative Jordan?
Present.
Representative Keeler? Representative Moeller?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Poston?
Present.
Representative Scott?
Present.
Representative Erdahl?
Present.
Representative Wasliwick?
Present.
Representative Christensen? Representative Keeler? Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Vice Chair Hassan, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes from March 8th?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I move those minutes.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hassan. Any discussion to the motion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are approved. Members, I want to ensure that you're all aware that the amendment requests need to be to nonpartisan staff no later than 10 a.m. on Thursday. Amendments can also be submitted to the CA, Laura Takenholtze, directly as well. Please be sure to include the name of the author on any submitted amendments. Today, we will be doing a informational walkthrough of the DE1 related to House File 1081. And with that, Ms. Para, I would ask that you please proceed with the walkthrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I will start with Article 1, General Education. This article amends statutes relating to school calendars and absences and counts of American Indian students and other technical changes. Section 1 requires a school board to notify parents of the district's policy relating to absence from school to religious observance. Section 2 allows a school board to consider the community's religious or cultural observances when adopting a school calendar. Section 3 requires the commissioner to provide an annual report of American Indian students data, American Indian student data using the state count of American Indian students. Section 4 requires the state counts of American Indian students to be used to calculate American Indian education aid. Section 5 amends a reference to the process to appeal a denial of certification of a third-party vendor's products and services. Section 6 amends a timeline for the county auditor to report on excess tax increment distributed to a school district. Article 2 is the Education Excellence Article. Section 1 allows educational data to be disclosed to tribal nations about tribally enrolled or descendant students. Section 2 requires student records transmitted when a student transfers schools to include pupil withdrawals and services a student needs to prevent inappropriate behavior from recurring. Section 3 modifies requirements for homeschool instructors. Section 4 modifies the reporting requirements for students for children receiving homeschool instruction. Section 5 requires school districts to adopt the state arts standards rather than local standards and adds media arts to the list of arts areas that districts must offer. Section 6 clarifies the commissioner's authority to amend rules on academic standards. Section 7 makes several changes. One is that it states that Algebra 1 taken in the eighth grade does not bear high school credit. It also requires a course in government and citizenship in 11th or 12th grade. for students that begin ninth grade in the 22-23 school year and later, and gives some other options to fulfill that requirement. It also requires the district to begin to offer a course for credit in government and citizenship students in 11th and 12th grade. It requires that art standards be state standards rather than local standards, requires one credit of physical education, and reduces the number of elective credits from 7 to 6. And finally, it requires students beginning ninth grade in the 21-22 school year and later to complete a personal finance course for credit during the senior year. Section 8 amends the World's Best Workforce statute by adding several definitions, including ethnic studies curriculum, anti-racist, institutional racism, and on track for graduation. Section 9 adds performance measures to the World's Best Workforce statute plan and requires districts to report on participation and performance on AP, IB, and dual enrollment programs. Section 10 requires districts' World's Best Workforce plans to include ethnic studies curriculum in anti-racist and culturally sustaining curriculum and modifies other plan requirements. Section 11 requires the World's Best Workforce District Advisory Committee to recommend strategies on curriculum and learning and work environments. Section 12 codifies a new grant. It's the Equitable School Enhancement Grants. It defines several terms in Subdivision 2. It requires grants to be used to support equitable anti-racist education practices. Section 13 modifies the Gifted and Talented statute, requiring services in addition to programs, and requiring identification assessments and procedures to be sensitive and equitable to underrepresented groups and to be coordinated for optimal identification of programs and services for underrepresented groups. Section 14 eliminates the requirement that the statewide tests include below and above grade test items. Section 15 requires the commissioner to develop and publish security and privacy policies and procedures on remote testing. Section 16 requires districts and schools selected to participate in the National Assessment of Educational Progress or similar assessments to do so. Section 17 modifies demographic categories for student data reporting. Section 18 strikes obsolete references to dates in federal law. Section 19 prohibits prohibits districts from adopting American Indian mascots. Section 20 defines in-school suspension and out-of-school suspension and requires an out-of-school suspension to include a readmission plan. Section 21 defines non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices as alternatives to removal or dismissal that requires school officials to intervene and redirect and support the student's behavior before removal or dismissal. Section 22 defines a pupil withdrawal agreement and limits a pupil withdrawal agreement to 12 months. Section 23 prohibits dismissal of a student in kindergarten through third grade unless non-exclusionary discipline measures have been exhausted and there is an ongoing serious safety threat to the child or others. Section 24 requires a school to use non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices before dismissal proceedings or pupil withdrawal agreements. Section 25 states that alternative education services are required when a student is suspended for more than 5 consecutive days. Section 26 requires an administrator to ensure alternative education services are provided when a pupil is suspended more than 5 consecutive school days. Section 27 requires school officials to give suspended students the opportunity to complete work assigned during the suspension and receive full credit for the assignments. Section 28 requires the written notice of intent to expel a student to describe the non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices that were offered to avoid the expulsion, and requires the department's list of legal resources to be posted on the department website. Section 29 requires admission or readmission plan to include measures to improve the student's behavior and lists optional elements of the plan. It also requires the plan to include parental involvement in the admission or readmission process. Section 30 requires districts to report on pupil withdrawal agreements and non-exclusionary disciplinary practices to the commissioner. Section 31 requires the commissioner to issue guidance on engaging stakeholders to review and revise discipline policies that are restorative and responsive, and requires the policies to include non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices. It also requires schools to ensure students are getting alternative educational services to make sure students are still eligible for school-based or school-linked mental health services. Section 32 defines prone restraint and prohibits a district employee or agent from using prone restraints to reform or punish unacceptable conduct. It also prohibits using some physical holdings. Section 33 requires a school board to annually review and revise the school discipline policy and include the policy parameters for when input into discipline decisions is allowed. It eliminates mandatory grounds for removal and eliminates the requirement that the policy include minimum consequences for violations of the code of conduct. Section 34 prohibits a post-secondary institution that makes admissions decisions based on students' race, color, creed, and certain other grounds from enrolling PSEO students. Section 35 modifies the dates for a student who intends to participate in PSEO to notify the district of the intent to enroll. Section 36 reduces the withdrawal and absence periods from first 14 to the first business days, which speeds up the time that a department would stop payment to the post-secondary institution. Section 37 defines hybrid learning. Section 38 and 39 amend the learning year program by striking references to an extended school day calendar and striking charter schools from the statute since they're not authorized to operate learning year programs. Section 40 modifies the description of instruction in American Indian language, literature, history, and culture by eliminating the word supplemental. Sections 41 and 42 relate to the American Indian Parent Advisory Committee. It defines the committee and requires a majority of the committee to be parents of American Indian children. Section 43 clarifies that the duties of the Director of American Indian Education may be performed by the designee. Section 44 requires a district or charter school to allow an American Indian student to wear American Indian regalia, tribal regalia, or objects of cultural significance at a graduation ceremony. Section 45 modifies the achievements and integration plan requirements. Section 46 and 47 relate to restrictive procedures, which currently that statute applies only to students with disabilities, and this would broaden that to other students as well, and prohibit using restrictive procedures on a child younger than 5. Section 48 allows an American Indian person to carry a medicine pouch containing loose tobacco in observance of traditional spiritual or cultural practices, and expands the definition of Indian for purposes of this section. Section 49 extends the time for the commissioner to post accountability data for the current school year to October 1. Section 50 requires the commissioner to suspend review and revision of academic standards and benchmarks in math and implementation of revised physical education art standards until June 1 of next year. Section 51 instructs the revisor to renumber statutory provisions on statewide assessments and reporting. And Section 52 repeals subdivision 5 of 120B35, which requires districts to develop strategies relating to students with emotional or behavioral disorders and graduation rates. Article 3, the teacher's article. Section 1 sets a goal to increase the percentage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers in Minnesota. Section 2 requires a school board to adopt a written policy that prohibits discrimination or discipline for a teacher or principal for incorporating into curriculum contributions by persons in a protected class. Section 3 requires a teacher to hold a license or permission aligned to a content area and scope of the teacher's assignment to provide instruction in a public school or charter school. Sections 4, 5, and 6 amend definitions of teacher, field, and shortage area. Section 7 amends definition of teacher preparation program. Section 8 states that teacher preparation program providers include both post-secondary institutions and alternative providers. Section 9 defines a district as a public school district or charter school. Section 10 is on teacher preparation providers, and a lot of the provisions that are currently about teacher preparation programs are moved into this new statute on preparation providers. Section 11 makes a technical change to the definition of teachers and states that the definition does not apply to certain other sections. Section 12 modifies the definition of qualified teacher. Section 13 is on substitute teachers and requires Pelsby to issue licenses to substitute teach to qualifying applicants. Section 14 modifies the background studies requirements for persons applying to be teachers or administrators. Section 15 limits the licensure via portfolio process to a Tier 3 license or to add a licensure field to a Tier 3 or 4 license. Section 16 requires application for a Tier 1 license to be submitted by both the applicant and the district and for one of those to pay the application fee. Section 17 modifies the exemption from a bachelor's degree requirement for a Tier 1 by replacing the reference to career technical education or career pathway to a specific exemption that's under state or rule. And then Section 18 goes more into those exemptions from the bachelor's degree and adds the exemption for teachers of world languages and culture and art and applicants enrolled in state-approved preparation program classified as a residency model. Section 19 modifies the renewal requirements for a Tier 1 license. And it requires districts to demonstrate professional development opportunities and other supports were provided to a Tier 1 teacher. Section 20 requires Pelsby to review applications and allows them to begin reviewing those before July 1. It also eliminates the requirement that a decision be made within 30 days. Section 21 allows Tier 1 teachers to be in the same bargaining unit as other teachers. Section 22 replaces the requirement that a Tier 1 teacher participate in the district's existing mentorship program and professional development, with the requirement that districts provide mentorship opportunities that are aligned to board-adopted criteria and professional development opportunities. Sections 23 and 24 modify the requirements for a Tier 2 license. It retains the bachelor's degree exemption for CTE teachers and expands it for teachers of oral languages and culture, who's a native speaker of the language and an art teacher with 5 years of work experience. Section 25 limits the renewal of Tier 2 license to 2 rather than 3. But allows the license to teach CTE to still be renewed unlimited times. And it requires district to offer professional development opportunities to a Tier 2 teacher in order to have that license be renewed, and a Tier 2 teacher has to participate in cultural competency training and mental illness training for all renewals. Section 26 requires Pelsby to review applications, and they can then begin reviewing them before July 1 and wouldn't have to make decisions within 30 days. Section 27 replaces the requirement that a Tier 2 teacher participate in the district's mentorship and professional development program with the requirement that they instead provide mentorship aligned to board adopted criteria. Section 28 eliminates licensure exams as a requirement for a Tier 3 license, and it broadens the exemption from a bachelor's degree to include a teacher teaching any course exempt by statute or rule. It requires Pelsby to issue a Tier 3 license also to an applicant who meets certain requirements. Section 29 eliminates the option for an applicant to meet the course requirement with 3 years of teaching experience under a Tier 2 license. And evidence of the district evaluations that didn't place the teacher in an improvement process. Section 30 expands the exemption from the bachelor's degree for certain teachers and requires Pelsby to adopt and revise rules. Section 31 requires a Tier 3 teacher to meet initial teacher renewal requirements to renew the license. Section 4 modifies what experience counts for the Tier 4 teacher. Eliminates the use of teacher evaluation in the licensure process and requires an applicant with a Tier 3 license to complete initial renewal requirements. Also requires Pelsby to issue a Tier 4 license to certain candidates. Section 33 requires a Tier 4 teacher to complete continuing teacher renewal requirements to renew the license. Section 34 eliminates the requirement that a Tier 4 teacher pass the skills exam and eliminates the pedagogy and context exams for Tier 3 teachers. It also provides other options for the pedagogy and content requirements. And it requires testing centers to provide opportunities for untimed content and pedagogy exams. Section 35 requires teacher prep providers to report annually on supports provided to persons in their programs who don't pass their exams. Section 36 eliminates the requirement that Tier 3 and 4 teachers show evidence of successful teaching or administrative experience for at least 1 year. It removes cultural competence and practice in meeting the needs of English learners from professional growth requirement that instead becomes a separate requirement. Section 37 allows teacher prep programs for bilingual and English as second language teachers to be provided outside of colleges or universities. Section 38 includes community education teachers in the definition of teachers for purposes of tenure or continuing contract. Section 39 modifies the probationary period for a teacher who's taught for 3 consecutive years in one state. So it allows those teachers to get continuing contract status earlier. Sections 40 and 42 require districts to adopt a rubric of performance standards for teachers and include culturally responsive methodologies. Section 41 allows a district to negotiate a contract with a 1-year probationary period for a teacher, for certain teachers. Section 43 established Come Teach in Minnesota hiring bonuses that districts can give to teachers who would qualify for a Tier 3 and 4 or 4 license and who belong to a racial or ethnic group underrepresented among teachers in the district. Section 44 requires the Collaborative Urban and Greater Minnesota Educators of Color grants to be awarded for 2 years, and then Section 45 modifies the reporting for those grants. Section 46 establishes grants for Grow Your Own programs, and there establishes 3 types of programs, which are defined in that statute there. Section 47 modifies eligibility for mentorship program grants. Section 48 requires principal evaluations to support and improve a principal's culturally responsive leadership practices. Section 49 requires time for paraprofessionals assigned to work with students with disabilities to be given time to review the student's individualized education program or be briefed on the student's needs and to be provided paid orientation or professional development. Section 50 modifies the list of things that districts and the teachers union or the employee unions have to negotiate. It adds class sizes, student testing, and student to personnel ratios. Section 51 repeals various statutes relating to teacher licensure. Article 4. Charter school. Section 1 adds several definitions, including charter management organizations and education management organizations. Sections 2, 3, and 4 add to the list of statutes that charter schools have to comply with. Section 5 modifies the term of the charter school authorizers, and Section 6 amends the withdrawal requirements for the authorizers. Section 7 requires an application to establish a charter school to include a market need and demand study. Section 8 also adds the market research that's for the authorizer's affidavit. Section 9 also requires the market need and demand study to add grades or primary enrollment sites. Section 10 requires the charter school admission to be free to a Minnesota resident and gives them enrollment preference over out-of-state residents. Section 11 changes the definition of teacher reference and the requirements so that charter schools can contract with a cooperative to provide necessary teachers. Section 12 requires a charter school to lease space from the owner of a space rather than subleasing the space. Section 13 requires a CMO or EMO to submit an audit report to the commissioner each year. And Section 14 strikes an obsolete reference to the chapter on cooperatives. Article 5, special education. Section 1 amends the requirements for an American Sign Language interpretation by adding a certain certification that would then allow school districts to use special ed funding for those interpreters. And Section 2 contains several provisions that would expire at the end of the 21-22 school year relating to students with disabilities and on-site instruction, home visits, truancy, and transition programs, which are programs for students ages 18 to 21. Article 6, health and safety, Section 1 requires school districts to provide mental health instruction. Section 2 requires districts to provide instruction to help students identify, prevent, and reduce prohibited conduct and take certain other action. Section 3 requires the commissioner to develop and adopt state-level social-emotional learning standards and to maintain resources to help schools implement strategies for a positive school climate. Section 4 defines mental health and describes comprehensive school mental health systems. Section 5 defines a multi-tiered system of supports, commonly known as MTSS, and lists required components of a framework. Section 6 requires districts to and charter schools to develop seizure action plans. Section 7 establishes a comprehensive school mental health services lead at the Department of Education. Article 7. Section 1 requires districts to establish school meals policies. It prohibits school district that receives lunch aid from denying a meal to a student who qualifies for a free or reduced price meal. And it requires districts to provide meals in a respectful manner. Section 2 states that library basic system support aid provided to a regional public library system is subject to the reduced maintenance of effort requirements. Article 8 is just one section requiring a district, charter school, or non-public school to notify staff, students, and parents if it receives notification of environmental hazards. Section 9 modifies the number of LSB members, changing it from 11 to 13. And Section 2 modifies the composition of PELSB, so the number of teachers, the qualifications, et cetera. Section 3 eliminates obsolete language. Section 4 requires PELSB to approve teacher preparation providers. Section 5 amends the requirements for the register of licensed teachers. Section 6 requires PELSB to adopt and revise rules, so it modifies the list of sections that require rulemaking. Section 7 eliminates annual review requirements for permission for alternative education program teacher to teach in other content areas. Section 8 changes the date that PELSB must report on teacher preparation programs. Section 9 clarifies reporting requirements on the number of candidates who have not passed a licensing exam. And finally, Section 10 strikes an obsolete reference to the licensing division of the department. And that is the walkthrough, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Para, for the walkthrough. Members, we are going to move on to onto public testimony. And I also want to thank the testifiers for waiting for us today with our late start. And just as a reminder, if we are not able to get to member questions and discussion today, that we'll have plenty of time on that for Friday as well. We have a number of testifiers, as always. Testimony is limited to 2 minutes, and we will get through as many testifiers as possible before 3:15. I will announce who is speaking and who is on deck so that you can be ready to unmute. And we will start with Adosh Uni, and on deck we have Matt Shaver.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you so much. My name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for the important work that you've done to put this bill together and includes many important provisions, including many from the governor's bill, which support all students, but include critical and much needed changes to ensure that our Black, Brown, and Indigenous students and students with disabilities are treated equitably in a safe, welcoming, and inclusive environment. So many of the proposals support the whole child and all the needs they have in order to reach their true academic potential. The need for this is even more so as we engage in recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. In order for our students to succeed academically, they need to be able to be in the classroom and treated with dignity and respect while there. Non-exclusionary discipline practices are central to providing the dignity and respect for our students. We know that our Black, Hispanic, and Native students are disproportionately impacted by exclusionary discipline practices. We're also grateful to see the support for those approaches in the bill, which builds on the progress made last year with our prohibition of pre-kindergarten dismissals by extending that same prohibition to grade 3. We're also appreciative of language around restorative practices and restrictive procedures. The multi-tiered systems of support definition provides a foundation for the work that can be done with the MTSS proposal in the governor's budget bill as well. We also support the many provisions that reflect the work of the Teacher of Color and American Indian Teacher Coalition to increase the number of Black, Brown, and Indigenous teachers in our classrooms, and in making sure those classrooms are culturally inclusive and racist practices. Supporting our American Indian students and their unique cultural identity is paramount to culturally inclusive schools. This bill has a range of proposals that establish clear and important expectations around education for American Indian students. We also appreciate the inclusion of several provisions that support the work of the department, including language that provides relief to districts and schools around standards while allowing us to do our important standards review and revision work. Thank you again for all your work to craft this much needed amendment and this bill and the opportunity to testify before you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Uni. Up next, we have Matt Shaver, and on deck, we have Ben McKenzie.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Shaver, and I'm the policy director at Ed Allies. I want to start by highlighting a number of great policies in this bill: a ban on kindergarten through third grade dismissals, expansion of college and career readiness measures in the world's best workforce, and a ninth grade on track indicator, prohibiting schools from lunch shaming students, and the bachelor's degree exemption for world languages and arts teachers. I'm grateful to see the committee taking action to advance these policies and believe they will increase education equity in our state. That said, Ed Allies strongly urges the committee to reconsider the inclusion of harmful tiered licensure changes that restrict eligibility for teachers from diverse backgrounds, creating hurdles for teachers of color that are disproportionately represented on tiers 1 and 2, and limiting pathways to becoming a teacher. In 2017, this body told prospective tier 2 teachers that if they taught for at least 3 years and received good evaluations, that they could receive a permanent tier 3 license. If we're serious about recruiting and retaining teachers, particularly teachers of color and teachers in licensure shortage areas, we cannot keep changing the rules for them. I know members of this committee are parents, guardians, grandparents, aunts and uncles of school-aged children. And I wonder, do you know what tier of license your kid's teacher holds? While I was teaching, no student or family member ever asked what tier of license I had or where I did teacher prep. They cared about whether or not I cared about their kid, if I was going to hold them to high expectations or let them slide by, if I was patient and respectful. A week ago, teachers took an hour and a half out of their workday before this committee for 2 minutes to beg for their license. These are people who were teaching before the pandemic, are teaching during it, and want to continue teaching after it. They've spent years earning a license in good faith that this body would hold up their end of the deal. Their concerns were dismissed. Teachers are not asking for these changes. Parents and families are not asking for these changes. Administrators and districts are not asking for these changes. And students are not asking for these changes. So why are we doing it? If you want to honor all teachers, please do not advance these license changes. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you all for your public service.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Ben McKenzie, and on deck, we have Paula Cole. Not hearing from Ben McKenzie, we will move on to Paula Cole. And on deck, we have Bob Indahar. Paula Cole.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chair Richardson and members of the House Education Policy Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. My name is Paula Cole. I am the Executive Director of Educators for Excellence Minnesota, a teacher-led nonprofit with approximately 2,300 members. E40 Minnesota supports many components of House File 1081, including the language from the 2021 Teachers of Color Act, which will make it a priority to recruit and retain diverse educators. We also support the promotion of non-exclusionary discipline measures and the provisions to elevate access to advanced coursework through the world's best workforce. We are particularly excited about how we define anti-racism, and it outlines mandatory process to examine the equitable distribution of teachers. I have to say, however, we strongly oppose the provisions in Article 3 of the bill that will alter Minnesota's proven and successful de-licensure program as it relates to Tier 1 and Tier 2 licenses by limiting the use of licensure via portfolio, removing or limiting the number of renewals, and what's worse, really, striking the allowance of 3 years of teaching experience under a Tier 2 license in order to move to a Tier 3 license. I am a Tier 4 licensed teacher right now, but I began teaching with what you know today as a Tier 1 license. I can't emphasize enough how important it is to protect pathways into the profession for teachers like me. This committee has spent significant time and attention this session on raising the voices of diverse educators and also achieving racial equity. It will really be a shame to walk back the years of progress we've made through Minnesota's Tier licensure system. If any of the things I say created any questions for you, please reach out. I'll be happy to talk more, and I hope that we can remove the prohibitions about Tier licensure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Bob Indahar. On deck, we have Kevion Ellis. Bob Indahar.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Bob Indahar, the Executive Director of Minnesota Rural Education Association. We represent 230 rural school districts across the state. I will be focused on a couple of provisions in the omnibus bill and give a rural perspective. The first area I'd like to comment on is the changes to the tiered licensure. I want to reiterate how acute the teacher shortage is in rural schools. I hear multiple stories from superintendents and principals who are unable to get applicants for a position and need to find creative ways to fill a position. Many times it deals with hiring someone on a Tier 1 or Tier 2 licensure level. This is why MREA has a concern with or narrowing licensure at this time. We are opposed to taking away of a teacher to move from Tier 2 to Tier 3 licensure who has 3 years of experience in the position. Also, there are many paths for the Tier 2 licensure that have been taken away in this bill. The other provision that we are opposed to is reducing the number of renewals that a teacher can have in their Tier 1 and Tier 2 licensure areas. We believe that these changes make an already bad teacher shortage even worse. We do like the continued flexibility shown for Tier 1 and Tier 2 licensure in hard-to-find areas such as CTE, World Language, and Visual Arts. Another benefit of the changes in this bill is that it will be easier for people from other states or countries to become licensed. The second area MREA has a concern with is the new graduation credit requirements that are being included. In the bill, it's calling for new courses in government and citizenship, FIED, and personal finance. Every new credit requirement equates to a loss of elective credits. Small rural schools do not have the luxury of having the number of staff or students to offer multiple sections of electives. Kids in rural schools will not have the opportunity to explore career fields.
Time. I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to cut you
thank
off.
You. There, well, thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Kevion Ellis, and on deck, we have Denise Dietrich.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Kevion Ellis with Education Minnesota, and on behalf of our 80,000 plus members from across the state, we just want to thank you for putting together a lot of great provisions in the bill, and I will highlight a few. So in Article 3, Section 21, regarding Tier 1 bargaining, this would allow Tier 1 teachers to voluntarily join the local bargaining unit, allowing all teachers to negotiate together for the resources that they need. And then in Section 23, regarding the Tier 2 loophole, this will require that lifelong teachers have training in pedagogy to meet the needs of all of their students in the classrooms. Just to be clear, this will not remove any teachers from the profession, but recognizes the need to provide more tools and professional development for newer teachers. In Section 38, regarding community education, this adds early childhood, family education, and adult basic education teachers to the Continuing Contract Law and Teacher Tenure Act, which means that these teachers would have notice about whether or not they will be returning the next school year. And then in Section 49, regarding paid training for paraprofessionals, this would require a minimum of 16 hours of paid training for paraprofessionals who work directly with students. We've heard from a number of ESPs who have had little to no initial and or ongoing paid training, which in return can negatively impact their ability to meet the needs of our students. And then lastly, in Section 50 of Article 3, this would expand the list of mandatory subjects of bargaining, allowing educators to be able to organize collectively around the real issues impacting our students, like class sizes, supports for English language learners, school counselors and nurses, the frequency of district level testing, and so forth. With this, Minnesota educators can start addressing. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Denise Dietrich, and on deck, we have Ryan Stromberg. Denise Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Denise Dietrich, speaking on behalf of the School Boards Association, the school administrators, and the Metropolitan School Districts. We appreciate the work members have put into House File 1081. We are still hopeful that some of our concerns expressed in testimony or in letters submitted can be worked out as this bill moves forward. 1081 has a significant number of new unfunded mandates that will pose hardships on our districts, both financially and time-wise. And this comes at a time when the staff are already feeling overwhelmed due to the disruptions caused by COVID-19. So for today, I will only be able to mention a few. The changes in academic standards will result in fewer opportunities for our students. By increasing classes for credits, their choices are decreased. The new tiered licensure system has provided the districts the flexibility to hire and retain staff that reflects our students and their needs. We know that there are more teachers of color in Tier 1 than Tier 4. We are building on something really promising here, so let's just continue that work. Our ECFE and ABE teachers provide relevant programs to our families through a market-driven staffing model. Changing this model forces us to pay for salaries and benefits regardless of the enrollment. We understand the need for additional training for paras as long as the revenue is allocated. As school boards and superintendents, we strongly oppose negotiating class size, student testing, and staffing ratios. These items fall under inherent managerial rights and should not be negotiated. And lastly, the world's best workforce is intended to be a data-driven strategic planning process for schools and their communities. When the legislature requires additional reporting, it changes what the world's best workforce was intended to be. And then lastly, we want to thank you for
Thank you for your testimony. And just as a reminder to testifiers, you can always submit written testimony if there's more that you would like the committee to be aware of. Up next, we have Ryan Stromberg, and on deck, we have Jennifer Murray.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the House. You have received a document from us. It's from the Minnesota Association of School Personnel Administrators. I'm also the Director of Human Resources and Organizational Development for Spring Lake Park School District. I will be succinct, but there's also a document that's been submitted. We're focused right now on the elimination of the bridge, the line 6822 to 6825. Ed Allies has already spoke to this. However, really what it gets at is we have really great tiered system developed by the House and the Senate in our legislation already. We're 3 years in. We have too many of our teachers of color and so many other of our teachers already in this program. And if we have a goal, it's not to perpetuate any more institutional racism within our different statutes, especially 122A.40. So let's continue to keep the language as is, so we can continue to support our teachers that are in these programs and in these tiered licensures. That is under the, 6822 to 6825. Under ECFE, continuing contract rights for ECFE teachers, the one thing we want to pay attention in this bill is This is revenue generated by parents who are signing up to participate, unless there's a funding source to go along with this, to offer continuing contracts to teachers in this area could be a hardship for school districts, also just in the fact of based on revenue coming into the school district.
30 seconds. And then
lastly, is expanding the subjects to mandatory bargaining lines 9515 to 9517, right, is the last thing we want to do is put more operational decisions into situations where we're bargaining over things that will have negative impact, again, on our teachers and our workforce. The last thing we want to do is eliminate some of our newest teachers to this profession based on really poor decisions at the bargaining. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Jennifer Murray and on deck, Beverly Tinney.
Ani, Madam Chair and Education Policy Committee members. My name is Jennifer Murray. I'm the chair of the Tribal Nations Education Committee. The Tribal Nations Education Committee representatives are selected by our respective tribal leaders and also approved and appointed by MIAC, which is Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. I'm a citizen of the Fond du Lac Reservation and also the superintendent of the Fond du Lac Ojibwe School. I'm super excited to talk on behalf of TNEC today, and this is exciting news to read through this policy proposal for this bill. I appreciate your time and consideration and the support of improving the educational experiences of our American Indian students in the state of Minnesota. This bill has many facets of our education system. There's over 26,000 American Indian students across the state. Unfortunately, according to MDE, American Indian Achievement Report, year after year, shows us is heartbreaking. We have the lowest graduation rates, attendance, and achievement. This bill will help support our students and families to promote and make us feel safe in schools and show that our values, I'm sorry, it's very, reading through this is very hard. Our tribal nations would like access to the data. This bill supports so many things we've worked very hard on for the last 10 years. In addition to that, this bill also helps our parents to have a voice in the schools and our students to feel that they're part of a school and not just an addition and or other. It also helps our students to promote their success within the schools and then show how our values help promote the state also of Minnesota. We would appreciate and keep the language of cultural significant.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Johnson, and for your work on behalf of Indigenous students as well. We appreciate your passion and your support around the issue. Up next, we have Beverly Tinney, and on deck, we have Roger Aronson.
Chairman Richardson and members, my name is Beverly Tinney, and I have been a special education paraeducator for 15 years, and I am a member of SEIU Local 284. I'd like to thank the chair for including the para training provision in this bill. Training and IEP access are crucial to our ability to do the very best for our students. Across Minnesota, para educators are asked to learn on the job, on the fly, how to support these our most vulnerable students. Just as importantly, it is impossible for us to support students to learn and grow and become independent if we don't know what their goals and educational plans are. More often than not, we don't even have time set aside to read IEPs. This provision would allow paras to meet with the IEP teams to learn about their students' unique and individual needs before the beginning of the school. This sounds like a small change, but it would make a huge difference in our lives and the lives of our students. To best serve our students, we need opportunities for training, which this bill will provide. Training in de-escalation and behavior intervention strategies, as well as a host of other issues such as trauma and multicultural training. We love the work we do, and we want to be prepared with the tools that we need to do our job in the very best possible way. I'd also like to thank the chair for including the prohibition on meal debt shaming. As an organization representing nutritional service workers, SEIU has always known that adequate nutrition is one of the most important factors influencing student growth and academic success. Children behave and learn better when they're well nourished. Ensuring that every student can access school nutrition programs regardless of their parents' ability to pay is crucial to ensuring student success. The changes in this bill are a positive step to protect students against meal debt shaming. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your work on this bill.
Thank you for your time. Up next, we have Roger Aronson, and on deck, we have Paul Spies.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Roger Aronson. I represent the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals and the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association. These two organizations represent over 2,000 elementary and secondary principals throughout Minnesota. School principals have significant concerns about multiple provisions in the bill. We do not support the proposed modifications to the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. While we agree that efforts must continue to address disparities in suspension and discipline, we're deeply concerned that the proposed changes do not effectively further that goal and do not provide the necessary resources and supports to address the underlying behavioral issues. We believe that the proposed changes may have the unintended effect of making schools less safe for student teachers and staff, and we don't believe this is the right path. We are concerned with proposed changes to the grad standards, to the teacher evaluation changes that would have to be bargained, to post-secondary enrollment options, teacher licensure, other collective bargaining topics, and other provisions in the bill as well. A year ago, we began an unprecedented response to the global pandemic. Since that time, we've all struggled to maintain Minnesota's education system. Distance learning, hybrid learning, testing, masks, tracing, quarantines, vaccinations, all of these have become part of public school life. Right now, principals and teachers are measuring classrooms to see how many students can be accommodated with 3 feet of separation, how many people can attend activities, how will students get the credits necessary to graduate, how can we get students back that left us. Principals are awaiting guidance on things such as returning to school, extracurriculars, prom, and graduation. With all that in mind, school principals respectfully submit that we cannot support new legislative initiatives, the scope of which is represented in House File 1081. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Paul Spies. On deck, we have Johanna Marquis.
Hi, Chair Richardson and members. My name is Paul Spies, and I'm with the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota. Way back on January 27th, we had a strong hearing for the Increased Teachers of Color Act, HVF 217, in this committee. We're pleased to see almost all of it in this draft omnibus bill. The comprehensive provisions you have included from HF 217, as well as other education equity provisions from our other bills you've heard, will make systemic change in history, not only in this state, but in the country, because no other state has such comprehensive legislation needed to address their shortage of BIPOC teachers. In addition to those sections from HF 217 that will do much in policy to help increase BIPOC teachers and ensure a better return on state investments, we also appreciate about 20 other sections that together will also do much to create more equitable learning and work environments needed to attract and retain BIPOC teachers. For brevity, I'll submit those numbers of sections in written testimony. There is one section, however, we'd like you to reconsider. Because licensing exams do not prove teaching effectiveness that should be associated with Tier 4 licensure, we hope that you replace Article 3, Section 34, with language in Section 10 of HF 217. I note that for our strong hearing of the Increased Teacher of Color Act on February 24th in the Senate Education Committee, Pelsby provided written testimony regarding our bill SF 446. Quote, the proposal to remove testing requirements for educators that have completed teacher preparation maintains Minnesota's standards for high quality educators while removing an unnecessary barrier to professional licensure, unquote. Thank you for your leadership demonstrating this omnibus bill that will do much to advance education equity in the state, including attracting, preparing, licensing, retaining increased percentages of BIPOC teachers.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Johanna Marquis, and on deck, we have Michelle Chang.
Greetings, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jana Marquez. I'm a leader with Unidos MN and a member of the Ethnic Studies Coalition. I am here today to speak on the Ethnic Studies provision for the education policy omnibus bill. During my last 2 years of high school, I had the opportunity to go deep into slavery. I learned beyond the Underground Railroad or the narrative that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. I learned that our African, Black, and Brown relatives' history is beyond just their pain and suffering, that the stories and legacy of resistance and liberation are crucial to learning. These stories that I had never heard kept me engaged and connected to school, yet I was only given this opportunity because I had a community of educators that taught through an ethnic studies framework, educators that worked tirelessly to ensure that I had a holistic understanding of our U.S. history. Unfortunately, the same is not true for other students' experiences. As we saw from the 2019 report by the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, we have one of the worst achievement gaps in the nation, yet we are not listening to what our students want to learn, which would drastically address this issue. Students love to learn and take in new information every day, but students can only stay in the same structure for so long before they grow bored and irritated by the same arrangement. What we need is ethnic studies in our schools so that students feel more engaged. Schools can have the opportunity to connect content to the earth, let students walk outside and acknowledge the land of their ancestors, incorporate art into the history of multiple cultures, or have discussions about topics that affect their everyday lives. These are just a few things that ethnic studies can bring to students of Minnesota. This is why I believe that with ethnic studies, we can address our achievement gap and ensure students feel more engaged in education. So I urge the committee to support the ethnic studies provisions of this bill and to do so by adding the ethnic studies as your graduation requirement, because I believe that all students would benefit from this style of learning just as I have. Thank you again for your time and allowing me to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony, and my apologies for mispronouncing your last name. Up next, we have Michelle Chang, and on deck, we have Brian Lozinski.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much. My name is Michelle Chang. I'm with the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. We are a social justice network of 4,000 Asian Minnesotan leaders. We are also part of the Minnesota Ethnic Studies Coalition, composed of over 30 organizations across the state, including Education Liberation, UNIDOS, and Education Minnesota. On behalf of these organizations, I support the ethnic studies language within the Education Policy Omnibus Bill. We appreciate that the legislation recognizes the value of ethnic studies for all students and that it defines ethnic studies and encourages school districts to include ethnic studies in long-term strategic plans. However, we are disappointed to see that this legislation requires both civics and personal finance classes for all high school students, but it does not include ethnic studies as a requirement. Curricula shapes how we think, understand, and act in this world. Making ethnic studies a graduation requirement is critical. It will enable students to better understand the rich heritage, culture, and history of the land upon which we live, told from multiple and diverse perspectives. And ethnic studies also intentionally centers those who have been historically and systematically erased from mainstream curricula due to colonialism, racism, patriarchy, xenophobia, and linguistic imperialism. And when schools recognize and include the assets that students bring into the classrooms, students become more engaged and they develop a strong sense of empowerment and understanding of their identity. Again, I appreciate the language in the omnibus bill, and I strongly urge the committee to strengthen the ethnic studies instruction within this bill so all students have the benefit of an ethnic studies education. Thank you for your work on this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Brian Lozinski, and on deck, we have Sue Aberholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify today. My name is Brian Lozinski. I'm a professor of urban multicultural education at McAllister College and also an organizer with Education for Liberation Minnesota. And we're members of the Ethnic Studies Coalition. I'm here today with my daughter, Sedania, who's a high school student. We appreciate the ethnic studies language that's currently in the bill and definitely encourage the committee to go even further and center ethnic studies instruction for all Minnesota students, including a high school graduation requirement. As a college professor, I see the dire consequences of the absence of ethnic studies on a daily basis in terms of college readiness. Ethnic studies is not simply about including information about diverse groups and of people in the curriculum. That actually seems like a very minimal expectation. Rather, ethnic studies is concerned with the very questions that confront students. It's about deep investigation in the social conditions that have impacted the communities that are present in our state. Ethnic studies are academic disciplines that have existed for well over half a century and yet are mostly absent in Minnesota schools. These disciplines ask us to question how knowledge is created based on histories and social experiences among particular communities, lifting up Indigenous communities and communities of color. They allow us to have a broader perspective in asking fundamental questions about what it means to be free, what democracy means, or how natural environments position people to exist in different ways. You may think that our current education system is already doing this, but I'm here to tell you it does not. My students typically come to classes with a very narrow conception of knowledge. They often take democracy for granted. They think about language and geography in very technical ways, and they're not prepared to question the tacit assumptions about the world. Socrates said that an unexamined life is not worth living. Ethnic studies was created as a way to ask a new set of questions about the world and live out the Socratic imperative. We need to instill in Minnesota students the courage to question the world they were born into.
Mr.
They deserve this. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Sue Abderholden, and Julie Johnson is on deck.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Member Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Just wanted to point out a couple of things in the bill. We do support prohibiting K through 3 students from being suspended because they're not learning anything at that point. We need to really focus on teaching them those skills. We also support the changes for restrictive procedures. I do want to say that on the in Section 31, line 30.28, if a student gets moved to a new school district, that school-linked mental health provider can actually continue to provide services. And so I had suggested some alternative language to make sure that's why we set up school-link that way, that they didn't necessarily get disjointed from their provider. We support paraprofessionals getting that training. They need to understand these children in order to support them. We also, of course, support educating students on mental health. But I would suggest that you make sure that any instruction or presentations on suicide and self-harm are actually maybe approved by the Commissioner of Health or something like that. We've had way too many situations where a school district has invited in someone who's a survivor of suicide, who then proceeded to share their entire story, including all the details, which actually promotes contagion. And so we want to make sure that on this particular area that we're not actually causing more harm than good. We also had some suggestions relating to defining mental health systems so that we're lining up with the way we talk about it on the national level, including saying that we're in collaboration with community and mental health providers as well. And then, of course, we support the mental health lead position because we think that's an important part of this. So we appreciate the opportunity to testify today. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Julie Johnson, and on deck, we have Adil Abdul. Julie Johnson, not hearing from
you. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you now. Please proceed.
Okay, I guess you just won't see my video. My name is Julie Johnson, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Association of Christian Home Educators, and we strongly oppose the new state reporting mandate included in this bill, specifically with the requirements including proof of the testing plan for the previous year was fulfilled and submitting official test scores. This reporting requirement is contrary to the 2011 homeschool mandate reduction bill, which paved the way for simpler reporting requirements for Minnesota homeschoolers. School districts also concluded that they did not want to maintain unnecessary paperwork from homeschoolers. We are not clear why this onerous new requirement is being introduced, as there's no credible evidence to suggest that a change in homeschool testing reporting is necessary. And this addition does not solve a current problem nor address documented concerns shared by the public. By submitting these scores, it implies oversight. Why does the state need this data? Who is asking for this additional reporting requirement? And what are they planning to do with it? Oversight is only needed if the action to be taken is based on that oversight. We do not accept that children belong to the state in any way. They belong to parents first. It's a God-given authority. Parents, as the stewards of their homeschooled children, have an obligation to protect child data. Learning data is assumed to be for the purpose of monitoring growth. If this is the case, only those overseeing that educational process need to see that data. This would be a significant step backward for the homeschooling freedom in Minnesota. It would impose unnecessary and burdensome requirements on both homeschoolers and districts, and it would also provide government officials or other agents with the unconstitutional authority to see private data. Parents should be the ones who decide how their children are educated. We encourage you to remove the addition of the new state reporting requirements from this omnibus bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Ethiel Abdul, and on deck, we have Reverend David Bucks.
Madam Chair and members, thank you so much again for the opportunity to speak for my son and so many children like him.
Ms. Abdul, can you maybe speak up a little bit? You're coming in faintly.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. I am telling you, I am so 1999, not with this technology thing. Again, Madam Chair and members, thanks so much for the opportunity to speak for my son and other children like him. My name is Aidil Abdul, and as I've said, I'm really pissed off Somali autism mom because my son, who doesn't understand suspension, was suspended because the current law allows him. I'm hoping that the final education omnibus bill will have the following critical items: the non-exclusionary methods before kicking a child out from his or her educational environment, which is not an unfunded mandate. It is actually a funded mandate. Children should be kept in school, and they should find out what the behavior of that child is before they kick him out. Number two, banning suspending young students up to third grade. Number three, providing parents the ability to complain and appeal if their child is suspended wrongly and unjustly with a policy that has some teeth behind it. Number four, keeping the current teacher licensure system to ensure increasing teachers of color. And finally, number five, adopting and allocating necessary funding in increasing for real this time teachers of color. If majority of above items make it to the final education bill, I think I'm going to party like it's 1999. And if you are too young to remember, it was heck of a year. I thought I'd bring some light to this. Again, thank you as always for your time and for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Reverend David Bucks, and on deck, we have Richard Ngo.
Madam Chair and honorable members of this committee, thank you for your diligent work and for the opportunity to testify today. My name is David Bucks, and I'm a resident of a little town, Fairhaven, in Stearns County, and I'm the father of five children whom my wife and I homeschool. I'm speaking today against the adoption of the amendment found on page 9, as spoken to by Ms. Johnson just a moment ago. With this amendment, homeschool parents will be required to include a copy of official test scores in their letter of intent to homeschool. This is a significant change to the law with no apparent reason. It is a further erosion of rights that belong to parents by nature, rights that should be carefully guarded. Homeschooling parents are already compelled to make a concession when they have to agree to administer standardized tests in the first place. That concession by itself is dangerous because it assumes that parents' goals for educating their children are identical with the goals of the state, that the state has the final say on measuring the success of education, and that state goals for education may override the goals that parents have. That is contrary to the nature of our system of governments. Any state interest in education comes only by delegation of authority that originally belongs to parents. Parental authority comes first, and state authority is subordinate. State authority in the matter of education comes into existence only through the consent of those same parents that it is now seeking to bind. To add an additional requirement that test results must be submitted annually is to increase the force of that dangerous concession. It binds families to standards in education to which parents never have agreed, standards in which parents may have no say whatsoever, and standards with which parents may, in fact, fundamentally disagree. It binds families to standards in education that are subject to change, which have changed dramatically in the past and are likely to change in ways that may be fundamentally contrary to the way many honest, upright, and loving parents would choose to measure success in educating their children. I urge the members of this committee to strike the proposed amendment, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, and my apologies for mispronouncing your last name. Up next, we have Richard Noe, and on deck, we have Amy Buckmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Richard Noe, and my wife and I have been homeschooling our 8 children in Farmington for the past 20 years. I rise in opposition to lines 9.4 through 9.7 of this bill, as the previous speaker did. This is the provision with a new mandate for providing standardized test scores to the local school districts for all homeschooled students. I oppose this for 3 reasons. First, in the Homeschool Progress Report 2009 by HSLDA and Dr. Brian Ray, homeschooled students were excelling under existing laws. Quote, homeschoolers scored 34 to 39 percentile points higher than the norm on standardized achievement tests, unquote. The same study had this to say about state regulations. Quote, the degree to which homeschooling was regulated by state governments had no bearing on student test scores. Second point, additional regulations on homeschooling are a waste of taxpayer dollars. In a December 19th, 2019 Verify segment, Care 11 News offered this conclusion, quote, we can verify it's true. Minnesota schools are the worst in the nation when it comes to graduation rates for students of color, unquote. Instead of wasting money on unnecessary regulation, shouldn't Minnesota be focusing on those students with the greatest needs? The third and final point is this. Providing additional private information like test scores for homeschooled minors to the school districts could unwittingly expose that information to individuals who are not legally or constitutionally approved to view it. In a day and age where data privacy and cyberbullying are huge issues, I want to protect every bit of my minor children's data. In conclusion, the existing Minnesota laws on homeschooling are working. The funds for additional regulations could be better spent on students of color, and there is no need to further expose minor children's data. If it's not broke, don't fix it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Amy Buckmeyer, and on deck, we have Julie Bunn. Amy Buckmeyer.
Thank you. My name is Amy Buckmeyer, and I'm a staff attorney for the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, where we advocate for the rights of parents to direct the education and upbringing of their children. With over 100,000 member families, including several thousand in Minnesota, we're the world's largest homeschool advocacy organization. I'm going to be joining the earlier speakers and expressing concern with the portions of the bill found on lines 9.4 through 9.7, requiring homeschoolers to include proof that the testing plan for the previous year was fulfilled, a copy of the official test scores, and additional student information when submitting subsequent notices of intent to the local superintendent. This is a burdensome and unnecessary addition to the reporting requirements for homeschoolers. For context, homeschoolers in Minnesota provide an initial notice of intent to their local superintendent when they get started. The notice of intent includes certain information, such as the name of the student, a home address, and the test the parent plans to use to evaluate the student. A subsequent notice of intent gets submitted every year. The notice of intent to homeschool is precisely what the name says, a notice. It does not grant the superintendent authority to approve or deny a homeschool. Superintendents have no authority or responsibility to keep up with homeschoolers' academic growth or even make sure they're in compliance with the law. There is no follow-up. A notice of intent simply allows the superintendent to know, for record-keeping purposes, that this student meets the compulsory education requirements. If there's doubt about whether the homeschool family tested their student adequately or in other ways meets homeschool law, there are other provisions of the law that come into effect. So requiring homeschoolers to submit more documents with their subsequent notices of renewal, or of intent to renew, their notices of intent, would result in nothing but more paperwork and wasted time for both parents and superintendents. I politely request you remove this language. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Julie Bunn, and on deck, we have Rory Groves.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Julie Bunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Economic Education, known as MCE. MCE serves the over 25,000 Minnesota teachers that are asked to deliver the economics, personal finance standards, and benchmarks in the state. I wish to make 3 points today regarding the personal finance class requirement for graduation contained in this bill, occurring on lines 11.25 through 11.31. First, MC supports a required course in personal finance for Minnesota students to graduate high school. Students have shown that studies have shown that high-quality financial education positively changes financial behaviors, increases students' lifetime savings and financial security, and moreover, it has secondary positive impacts on their parents' and families' behaviors. Reliance solely on standards for financial literacy education can worsen social and racial inequalities. Research shows that under a standards-only approach, wealthier districts and schools provide more personal finance instruction than more diverse and less affluent schools and districts. Having a uniform requirement levels the playing field and helps close the achievement and opportunity gap for our students. Second, MCE stands ready to train and support teachers to deliver this course, including training them in culturally responsive methods. Every year, MCE supports teachers and school districts by providing them highest quality teacher professional development curriculum that we create and we find and curate from elsewhere. MCE is also a long champion developing and using culturally responsive teaching methods. Currently, though, there's a shortage of Minnesota teachers equipped to successfully deliver a required personal finance course, but this could be remedied in the timeframe specified. Finally, MCE believes the lawmakers, MDE, and external stakeholders should work together over the next year to develop consensus around standards for the class.
I'm going to have to cut you off there, Ms. Bunn. Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Rory Groves, and on deck, we have Neil Johnson.
Hello, Madam Chair and committee members, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm not coming to you as a lobbyist or representative of any organization. I'm just coming to you as a homeschooling dad of five kids who I love very much. My wife and I have been homeschooling for about 5 years, and I just wanted to share our perspective with some of the proposed language in Article 2, Section 4 of the new reporting requirements, which we feel would introduce new regulatory burdens on us that is not justified. As has already been testified very eloquently by a few others, such as David and Julie, this new regulation would just put undue paperwork on us, and there's the there's a situation of just having a hassle of having to comply with some of this stuff. But there's also the matter of, where is this coming from? What's the justification? Where is the evidence that this is needed? Our kids are thriving. They're doing very well. We already comply with the state's requirements that we conduct regular testing. And we, as their teachers, take that very seriously, and we give the testing so that we can teach them better. Ultimately, the point of education is for children to learn, and we feel that testing is one tool in that regard. There's no reason why the state needs to be privy to that information. And the second item, which has also been brought up, is just a matter of privacy concerns. I'm a technology consultant. That's my full-time job. And I'm very aware of all the data privacy issues that are out there. And as a father, I take this very seriously to protect the privacy of my children and the minors in our home. And I don't want to be divulging any information such as test scores, which could follow them or which could be not guarded carefully by administrators who don't know our family. Not that anyone has any particular intent. I just want to protect my children. That's part of my responsibility as their father. So that information belongs between the teacher and their children. And I thank you for this time to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Neil Johnson. And on deck, we have Amy Sauter. Neil Johnson.
Hello, and thank you for having me here today. I'm a homeschool dad of seven, and actually my first two have already are graduating. Well, one is graduating out of college and the other and has graduated. And homeschooling has been working really well for us. And we've actually taken part in the education system here in Minnesota through PSEO. Both of our first two children have been able to graduate college at the same time they graduated high school. And I am also concerned about lines 9.4 through 9.7. It does create a more burdensome and onerous problem for us. And again, to the point of, where is this coming from? Is it from the teachers unions? I don't know. But, you know, the fact is, I know COVID has created a situation where more people are homeschooling. And I don't know if that's the great concern and that's where that's coming from. But most Minnesotans know homeschool families at this point and have seen the successes of homeschool. So with so much success, the question, it begs the question, why are we seeing this right now? When we should actually be opening up more for homeschoolers. We should be looking at more choice and more freedom for homeschooling families, and maybe even looking at vouchers to help them in the ability to afford curriculum and those types of things that they all pay for out of their own pockets. Homeschoolers are outperforming public school children. They typically score higher on tests. There is no difference in test scores of homeschool children, even when the educational level of the parents is taken into play, because the biggest differentiator in a child's education and the success thereof is the student to teacher ratio, which in homeschooling you have the best student to teacher ratio possible. So I strongly encourage striking lines 9.4 through 9.7 out of this bill. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next we have Amy Sauter, and on deck we have Mary Lemke. Amy Sauter.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would reiterate what some of the previous testimonies have included. Again, as a homeschool mom in Minnesota, I have two who have graduated and are successful college students, three still at home. I'm a member of the Minnesota Association of Christian Home Educators and the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. Almost 20 years ago, exactly, on March 21st of 2001, the Senate Education Committee heard testimony on this very same matter, and the Senate committee unanimously voted to reject proposed rule changes due to the many valid reasons presented that day. The purpose for testing or assessing a child is to find out if they've retained information that they've been taught, and if there are significant gaps in that learning, then to make adjustments. This information is really useful for a teacher, but it really doesn't serve a purpose in the files of a superintendent's office. That statute 20 years ago stated that the parent of the child's primarily responsible for assuring that they acquire the knowledge and skills needed for effective citizenship. And over and again, many thousands of times in the state of Minnesota, much less millions nationwide, students are now very productive citizens from homeschooling. According to this same statute, the Department of Education already has the oversight over reporting requirements, as has been stated. Homeschools communicate directly to their local superintendent's offices regarding the administration of standardized tests. Parents also even have the option of letting their students take the tests in the local public school. So the documentation in the same statute states that it will be presented for examination for the purposes of monitoring compliance with what already is in place. We don't see a valid reason to interfere with the teacher-student relationship and the privacy afforded. Furthermore, it was in 2011, superintendents were glad to see less paperwork when the reduction bill passed as well. Again, I would just ask to please remove language from this omnibus bill that puts more reporting requirements on homeschoolers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Mary Lemke. And on deck, we have Jeff Springer. Okay, not hearing from Mary Lemke. Jeff Springer, you are up next. And on deck, we have Scott Kroonquist. Also not hearing anything from Jeff Springer. We have Scott Kroonquist and I believe Caitlin Snyder on deck, but we will go with Scott Kroonquist.
Hello, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and thank you for the opportunity to share a few comments about the omnibus policy bill. Madam Chair, at the start of the session, you noted that two of your highest priorities for the committee were to help students and families recover from the pandemic and to work to eliminate Minnesota's unacceptable racial disparities in educational outcomes. Those priorities are closely aligned with AMSD's legislative platform and with the Reimagine Minnesota work that our superintendents, school board members, and staff have been involved in since 2016. Our school leaders support and have been working to address many of the provisions in the bill, including diversifying our educator workforce, enhancing cultural competency for our staff, making the curriculum and school environment more inclusive and welcoming for all students, and eliminating racial disparities in discipline. As we work towards recovering from the pandemic, we ask that you keep in mind that new mandates and reporting requirements require staff time, and that is time that can't be spent, assisting our families and students to recover from the pandemic. We understand there's a balance between accountability and local control, but we ask as you work through the bill that you try to prioritize any new mandates, keep them to a minimum, and then fully fund any new mandates that are part of the final bill. Just one final issue I'd like to address, Madam Chair. And speaking in terms of recovering from the pandemic, our superintendents are hearing from a lot of families wanting to know if distance learning will be an option next year as they continue to recover from the pandemic. And so we are hoping that that is something that could still be addressed as you work through this session. Representative Edelson, I believe, has a bill, House File 1644, that would address that. And we're just hopeful that there's still time remaining in the session to consider that. So I'll stop there. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you for your testimony. Caitlin Snyder is on, looks like she may be connecting to audio now. Caitlin Snyder, you're on deck.
Madam Chair, thank you for your patience with me today. Caitlin Snyder with Education Minnesota. I'll be brief. I just wanted to speak in support of a number of provisions included in the DE today. First, Madam Chair and members, I wanted to thank you for including provisions in Article 3 related to strengthening the profession for teachers. Section 38 allows ECFE and ABE teachers to have continuing contract rights or Teacher Tenure Act protections. This will mean they'll know whether or not they're returning in the fall. Section 50 allows teachers to negotiate about class sizes. We know that our educators care about a lot more than their working conditions and their pay. They care about the challenges that our students are facing. So this is an incredible step forward for negotiating some of these pieces. Thank you for allowing Tier 1 teachers in Section 21 to join the bargaining unit voluntarily, like all public employees. And thank you for the changes in Section 23 that would ensure that our Tier 3 and Tier 4 teachers have some exposure to pedagogy. Our students all learn in different ways, and we need to make sure that the professional lifelong teachers in the classroom have the skills to meet all of their needs. And this pairs really well with some of the provisions you included about making sure Tier 1 and Tier 2 teachers have access to mentoring and have supports from the school district. So altogether, a great package brought forward today. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who is currently logged into the Zoom that has not testified that would like to testify? Okay. Hearing none, we have exactly 2 minutes left, and I know that Representative Drazkowski was the first to raise his hand, so we will start with you, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I had was, as we were reviewing the 100-and-some-page bill, I recognize a good number of items in there, Madam Chair, but I don't know that I recognized all of them. Can we get a list of which sections or bills we actually heard and which of them are additions in addition or items we did not hear in committee?
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski, for that question. And I will work with staff to help to kind of link that information for you all. A number of the bills, we do have a list of where we tracked sort of everything that was integrated in. So that's something that I'm hoping, I'm not speaking out of turn with staff, that we could have available for our next hearing.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, because I've been around long enough to know this is the point at which things get into the bill, that especially when it's over 100 pages that we might not have heard. And I want to make sure that we really did discuss each of the items in the bill.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. And we have a little less than a minute left. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will ask most of my questions on Friday when we do the markup. But, you know, to respond to Representative Drazkowski, this is primarily the governor's policy bill, Pelsby's policy bill, and increasing the teachers of color bill. So it really doesn't have anything in it. I don't think that's a shocker because the department provided so many policy changes. But, Madam Chair, what disturbs me,
Erickson, my apologies, but we are at 3:15.
I will speak Friday. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thank you, Representative Erickson. And with that, we are adjourned.